we'll be hearing from a Muslim writer and cultural commentator who's been described as one of the finest intellectuals on the planet. On ABC Radio National, on Radio Australia, and on the World Wide Web, you're listening to The Religion Report. Well, since September the 11th, 2001, how often have we heard it said that Islam needs to embrace modernity? Too often, according to leading Muslim intellectual Dr. Zia Sadar, who says that the West has enough problems with its own brand of modernity and that Islam is more than capable of critiquing and reforming itself. Zia Sadar was born in Pakistan and now lives in Britain, where he's a scientist, broadcaster and cultural critic, and he's also the author of a number of books, including the recent bestseller Why Do People Hate America? Dr. Sadar says that the West's great economic and military muscle is not supported by an adequately robust intellectual life, and that the major changes in human societies over the coming decades are going to be driven by paradigms of thought from China, from India, and from the Islamic world. Well, Zia Sadar is currently visiting our shores. He was a guest at last week's Brisbane Powerhouse Festival of Ideas, and he's speaking here with David Bush.
Islam cannot be modernized in Western terms. Indeed, modernity is a problem for the West itself. This is why we had a great backlash against Enlightenment and all the things that modernity stood for in terms of postmodernism. So modernity itself is a problem. So to ask Islam to actually embrace something that is already problematic seems to be rather daft. Modernity, by definition, looked down on tradition. And that was Islam's great problem with modernity, because modernity demonized tradition. And Islam takes tradition very, very strongly. And most Muslim communities are very traditional community. You know, we believe that change should take place within tradition. Tradition should reinvent themselves and move forward so people's identity is secure and etc. The great disservice that modernity has done to Islam is it has demonized tradition, which has resulted in all the problems of identity and history and so on and so forth, which has led to all the fragmentation and alienation of Muslim communities and all the problems that we actually see. I think what the Muslim thinkers and scholars are trying to do is to develop, if you like, a transmodern Islam, an Islam that is beyond modernity and beyond postmodernism as well, something that is not so absolutely relativistic that it becomes meaningless, but also something that is not so monolithic and based on sort of dominant notion of truths that it becomes totalistic. Transmodernism takes us forward within traditions which change and evolve. So that's the kind of openness that I think I see the future moving towards.
Now, implicit in that is that you're saying that there's a critique that the transmodern Islam would bring to what the West might like to see as its modernist or postmodern identity and achievements. What would that critique involve?
Absolutely. No, the critique is two-way. And I think I must emphasize the critique begins within Islam itself. For example, most Muslim thinkers are now saying that the whole notion of Sharia, the Islamic law, which has been conventionally regarded as divine, is not quite correct. That Sharia was socially constructed in history, particularly during the Abbasid period, when Muslims were, if you like, the imperial power. Right? So the kind of dynamics of the Muslim imperialism are integral to the construction of the Sharia. You know, and the whole group of young, brilliant feminist Muslim scholars who are exposing how, in fact, the whole gender relationship was socially constructed and then given, a divine gloss, as it were, by the religious scholars. So there will be serious rethinking within Islam. So we are now asking questions which conventionally Muslims have shied away from. So it's not a reformation or an enlightenment, in a sense. I mean, we are engaging Islam in terms of its own dynamic. And the main dynamic here is the notion of ijtihad, which means sustained reasoning. Now, ijtihad is a crucial part of Islam, but the gates of ijtihad were closed in the early part of, almost 13th, 14th century by religious scholars, mainly for the reasons of power, because they wanted to keep the interpretive power in their own hands. So what we are saying now is time that we had new ijtihad, that we had a new interpretation. So the first part of all that critique is we are trying to critique ourselves and our own worldview. Then the second part of that critique is, of course, we want to transform the West as well, because in a sense, the West needs to be rescued from itself. And part of the reason that we need to do that is because the West has become a major oppressive power and it's oppressing us. And one way we can actually do something about that oppression is to actually help the West to transcend its own limitations. And of course, one of its main limitations is the whole notion of Western modernity, where modernity is constructed as one Western truth, one way of being human, you know, one way of knowing, being and doing. And essentially, the West must come down from its apex that it has placed itself on and take its place as an equal in the ranks of other cultures and civilization.
But at the heart of what you might call Western modernity are basic principles that are key parts of the West agenda for the world. I'm thinking of things like human rights, personal freedom, participatory liberal democracies, environmental concerns. Are you saying that they ought to just stand as one way of looking at the world and Islam or other groups will hold other different views, or do you agree that those are fundamental values that all civilizations or all forms of modernity ought to share?
Well, the answer is yes and no, in a sense. You take the environmental concern. The environmental concern is not particularly a Western thing. I mean, the concern for environment is at the center of Islam. The second most important concept in Islam, the first most important concept in Islam is Tawheed, which means unity of God, which we extend that to mean unity of humanity and unity of man and nature. The second most important concept in Islam is the notion of Khilafah, which means men and women are trustees of God. So here we are, right at the center, the second most important concept makes this earth a trust. Environment is central to Islamic thought.
So you're saying that sustainability was an ancient Islamic concern?
I'm not just saying that sustainability was ancient Islamic concern. I'm saying much more than that. I'm saying sustainability has been a concern for all non-Western cultures. The Western culture has just discovered that, and now it wants to impose it on every other culture in the way it sees fit. Most non-Western cultures, including, say, the Australian Aborigines, are very self-sustaining cultures. And again, this idea of freedom. Tell me which community, which individual does not want to be free? Everybody wants to be free. I mean, why is it suddenly a Western notion that we should be free, right?
Well, it's because the Western countries tend to operate in a system of freedom, and a lot of the repression happens in non-Western countries.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. But if the Western countries had been exploited for last 400 years, you know, raped, pillaged, you know, economically denigrated, their culture abused, and their individuals told that they are less than human, well, I'm afraid they may not have been in the position that they are in at the moment either. So let us look at it in perspective. And the question of human rights. You see, human rights are very, very important. And there is no culture that would deny rights to the individual. But what you can't do is to allow only one particular notion of rights, human rights, and then impose that notion on every other society. For example, for most cultures, the most fundamental right is the right to food. The human rights, the way it is constructed, the most fundamental right is right to descent. Now, the right to dissent is important, and I'm not saying that should not be there. What I am saying, that if you're starving to death, you're not likely to dissent. The first thing you need is food. Then second thing you need is shelter. Now, the non-Western countries have been arguing for 30 years in the United Nations that the human rights agenda should be expanded to include things like food and shelter and, you know, basic education and so on and so forth. But the Western countries want to construct the notion of human rights only in political terms. We cannot have a single construction of human rights which only concentrates on one thing that suits the West or that is part of the Western perception. We need to broaden the agenda.
The implication being, if you broaden human rights to include food, then the West is culpable, because you would argue the West actually is monopolizing food distribution and production around the world.
Absolutely. You got it in one.
So in fact, what you're doing, you're turning the tables on the West critique of Islam, saying it has to catch up. You're actually saying Islam already encapsulates in its deep ethical heart the concerns that are very contemporary, and in fact has questions to ask back to the West why it doesn't live up to its own rhetoric.
Absolutely, absolutely. Our main problem is that the political constructions of the Muslim countries, the political system of the Muslim countries, have not allowed the basic Islamic ethics to come to the fore. If you take Saudi Arabia, for example, its despotic monarchy is basically maintained by the United States, right? And the kind of Puritan interpretation of Islam that the state forces on the rest of the society actually takes the ethics and morality of Islam away and just presents it as a mechanical thing. So that's why you get a very mechanical, very totalistic state, totally devoid of humanity. What we want are communities and states where Islamic humanity can also flower, where our ethics and morality can also become part of a society. And that is what has been difficult for us to do. In a sense, the political situation in the Muslim world is both a product of colonial legacy and part of our own shortcoming and how we have perceived Islam in a very, very narrow way.
Do you hold the view that the West then is intellectually and maybe spiritually a spent force, that the new ways of being human, the new understandings of how we live on this planet, will actually not come from the West?
I do detect Western thought kind of running into circles and reaching somewhat a dead end. I mean, if you look at the kind of major ideas that have been produced over the last 30, 40 years, the idea of development, for example, essentially an ethnocentric idea, that there are the two worlds, there's a developed world and a developing world, and a developing world must perpetually develop to catch up with the... Or the idea of growth, that the growth has to be perpetual and continuous. I mean, all that, for me, it tells me that the Western civilization is now groping in the dark and hasn't got very far to go in that sense. So I think the great ideas are going to come from non-Western cultures. Islam, India, for example, the whole idea of Aristotelian logic. We've had 2,000 years of Aristotelian logic, essentially based on yes and no. And, you know, we have a whole computerized world, which is great. But we need to go beyond that, because we are now discovering everything is complex and there are more answers than yes and no. And the next, I think, dominant logic will be Hindu logic, which is a very sophisticated logic. It's a fourfold logic which provides the answer yes and no, but also perhaps and maybe. And this is a very symbolic, very concrete logic, just as rational as Aristotelian logic, just as objective as Aristotelian logic. And it seems to me natural that we are going to move towards Hindu logic, because we just cannot solve all our problem from, you know, the old Aristotelian logic. The West doesn't seem to appreciate the whole notion of difference. I mean, it seems to me that in the Western conception, difference and fear are just totally related. And the idea that difference can also lead to dignity and respect, you know, has to be brought in. And this is a sophisticated idea, and that seems to exist, as far as I know, in non-Western cultures. And the whole idea is that you cannot separate, you know, values from hard reality. And most non-Western cultures just do not separate values from hard reality. I mean, in Islam, for example, we think science and values go hand in hand. And in fact, you know, we produced a great flowering of science for almost 800 years without separating, you know, values from science, values, you know, ethics, the question of ethics. And now it's all coming back. So I think non-Western ideas, non-Western civilizations, India, Islam, China, but also indigenous cultures. I mean, for example, I believe that the Aborigine culture in Australia has absolutely fantastic notions from which not just that we can learn, but in fact they will probably end up saving us. I mean, the idea of song lines is so sophisticated. The idea that knowledge can be a map is a very profound idea, which doesn't exist in the West. So here in Australia itself, you have two profound ideas, which are more profound than Australia has produced in the last 200 years. And they have to be the future. I just do not see how we are going to get out of the mess that the West has created for itself and the rest of humanity without using certain more profound ideas.
Do you mean in that also that the Judeo-Christian ethic or religion foundation of the West also is a spent force? It has nothing new to offer intellectually or spiritually, that we have to look at completely different religious systems and cultures?
You see, the Judeo-Christian heritage has become the dominant heritage. What I'm saying is that it is just one heritage, and it's a great heritage. I cannot possibly imagine it ever becoming a spent force. But the kind of thought that has come out of it has become a spent force. So in a sense, what we are doing within Islam, we are going back to our roots to reinterpret Islam, if you like. The West needs to do that as well. It needs to go back and, for example, I think secularism has led us to the present impasse. I mean, I'm willing to accept secularism as one mode of existence amongst many, but I do not think that we can survive in a world where secularism is the dominant mode. So what I'm saying is that, yes, the West does need to return to some of its religious and ethical values to shape a viable future for itself.
Dr. Zia Sadar, and if you're interested in publication details of some of his many, many books, you'll find them on our website, abc.net.au/religion. Just click on the link to the Religion Report and you'll find everything there, including a full transcript of today's program and lots of other information.